All right, we're going to continue with the larger and shorter catechisms, what man ought to believe concerning God. The larger catechism, question 16. Question 16, how did God create angels? Answer, God created all the angels, spirits, immortal, holy, excelling in knowledge, mighty in power, to execute his commandments and to praise his name, yet subject to change. There are a number of interesting questions that come up when we begin to talk about the doctrine of angels. And the Bible actually has a lot more to say about angels than people may be aware. We're going to go over a bit of that. It also does not have certain things to say about angels that people tend to think. For example, sometimes some certain kinds of angels are portrayed in the Bible as having wings, but not all of them are. And so whether or not they all have wings, or if we're to understand by people seeing wings that they are actual wings, or this is conveying something about the rate at which they travel, which is something that will probably be touched upon as we go tonight, that's not particularly clear in the Bible. It is clear that they can move rapidly. It is also not true that they are like little Cupid things. In fact, this idea of little babies with wings on their back is entirely unfounded in the Bible. We don't have any notion in Scripture of angels appearing or being made known in the form of anything other than adults and, as we'll see, particularly as men. But there is one passage that may refer to an angel appearing as a woman, but probably not. So we're not going to take that into our accounting because, with the exception of a very questionable passage with relation to this, it does appear that the angels show themselves to be males. Now, philosophically, there are a number of questions that we could also address. We will be right on the edge of some of these philosophical questions. One of which is a very famous question. How many angels can dance on the head of a pin? That question presumes something that we will see the Bible indicates, but really doesn't speak to in a way that we necessarily can become dogmatic, although there are philosophical issues involved. And that is a question of whether or not angels have some kind of incorporeal body. And that, I think, the answer to that, as we'll see, I believe, is yes. They do have some sort of incorporeal body, and that then really raises a question of, do they occupy extension into space? That was really the question at issue with that, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. So it's not a foolish question, although sometimes it's raised to make it sound like people who are asking philosophical questions are asking foolish questions. It's only foolish if our intention really is to try to disprove either the reality or the efficacy of angels. And we'll see as we go on that angels are not only real, but they are in fact so real that they are able and very often active in ways that we perceive. Even if we don't perceive the angels, nonetheless, they are active and they're around us. So we want to begin discussing this question by asking, first of all, what are the angels of God? What are they? Are they little divinities? Are they little gods? Because of the fall of some of the angels, and because of their ability, as we'll see, to impact material beings, people like we are, there has arisen throughout the history of mankind this conceit that there are a multiplicity of gods. And if we're talking about small g, Elohim, there's a sense in which that is correct. We're talking about spirit beings, as we will see. But the fact is that the gods of the heathen are really demons. They're fallen angels. And the reason there's a history of polytheism amongst fallen man is because he very easily was removed from worshiping the true God to worshiping not only of angels, but of fallen angels. So what do we understand instead? Well, we understand that the angels are to be accounted amongst those things which are created. They're not eternal. They're not like God in that sense. They're like God in the sense that they are spirit. They're not like God in the sense that they're eternal or, better yet, uncreated. They inhabit eternity, but they are not from eternity like God. So they are spirit beings that are able to move in some sense between eternity and time. That is, eternity where there is no duration, time where there is duration. They're somehow able to make this transition. But they're created, and they're advanced to the highest dignity and honor amongst the created things, though they subsist as things which are invisible. They are to be accounted among the invisible things of the creation. Nonetheless, they're very dignified and honorable. We want to begin looking at Nehemiah 9:6.
Nehemiah 9:6. Thou, even thou, art Lord alone. Thou hast made heaven the heaven of heavens, with all their host, the earth and all things that are therein, the seas and all that is therein. And thou preservest them all, and the host of heaven worshipeth thee.
Yeah, the angels then are to be noted amongst what we would consider to be the intelligent creation. The intelligent creation is divided into that which is visible and that which is invisible. They are, in fact, amongst that which is invisible. That it is of their nature to be invisible to the eye of man. That is, that because they are, as we'll see, incorporeal, without material bodies, they don't lend themselves easily to being seen. But they are intelligent creation, and thus they are employed in the most honorable of services by God. Daniel 9:21-22.
Daniel 9:21-22. Yea, whiles I was speaking in prayer, even the man of Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, touched me about the time of the evening oblation. And he informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I am now come forth to give thee skill and understanding.
In fact, we know that of the intelligent creation, they are, in fact, the most excellent of the two species of intelligent creatures, when we're talking about angels and men that were created by God. So of the creation, the angels are the more excellent of the intelligent creatures as to their creation, as to their nature. We see that if we look at Psalm 8, verses 4 and 5.
Psalm 8, 4 and 5. What is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him? For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels, and hast crowned him with glory and honor.
So as to creation, the angels are more excellent. As to the nature of the angels, that created nature, it is more excellent than man. God created two species of intelligent creatures, angels and men. Angels are, by nature, more excellent. And we'll talk about why in a few moments. Now, when God created, he first created the heavens and then the earth. And this is important if we look at Genesis 1, 1 and 2.
Genesis 1, verse 1 and 2. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters.
If we look at the account, Moses really doesn't give us an account of what transpired in the creation of the heavens, the higher heavens, I should say, so much here in Genesis 1. His accounting is really the lower heavens, the sun, moon, and stars, and the earth, and everything in it. But we know that the angels were created at the beginning as well, at the beginning of this creation, when God, in fact, not only creates in time, but with time, as I've said before, God also creates the angels. In fact, the angels are amongst those things which appear at the beginning of the creation of the earth and all that constitutes the material universe. That's clear if we look at Job 38, 4 through 7.
Job 38, 4 through 7. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. Who hath laid the measures thereof, if thou knowest? Or who hath stretched the line upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened, or who laid the cornerstone thereof? When the morning stars sang together, the sons of God shouted for joy.
When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. He's talking about the angels. They were there when God creates the earth. So exactly at what point they're created, it's very clear that their creation has to be sometime during these first couple of days of creation. Because when the earth, whatever is meant by the foundation of the earth, that has to be taken into account. The angels are there already, and they are, as it were, cheering God on as he's forming the earth and shaping all of the lower creation. So, angels are part of the creation. They're there at the beginning. They're called morning stars because they exceed all other creatures, including man, in glory. Revelation 2:28.
Revelation 2:28, and I will give him the morning star.
I'll give him the morning star. He's talking, there's this language. Jesus himself is called the morning star. he's the first of the creation of God in the sense that all other things are patterned after him. And as we'll see in just a moment, that doesn't just mean man. So they're morning stars, even as they're called that because they're exceeding the glory of all other creatures, even as the stars exceed the lower parts of creation in glory, which Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 40.
1 Corinthians 15, verse 40. There are also celestial bodies and bodies terrestrial, but the glory of the celestial is one, and the glory of the terrestrial is another.
Yeah, the glory of the celestial is one, the glory of the terrestrial another. There's this great magnitude of difference between the celestial and the terrestrial glory. And when we talk about celestial glory, heavenly glory in particular, at the top of the all things that pertain to heavenly glory are these angels. They're at the pinnacle of the creation of intelligent being. Right, they're called the sons of God. They're called the sons of God because they were produced by Him. They were, in fact, created in His image. Job 1:6.
Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them.
They're called the sons of God. They're produced by Christ. All things were made by Him, as we'll see in just a moment. And they are, in fact, like man, in some sense, created in His image. Because of that, they are, therefore, creatures arrayed under the headship of Christ. Now, they're not under His headship as redeemed men. But nonetheless, Christ is the head of all creation, and all intelligent creation in particular bears some relation to the image of God in Him. So look at Colossians 1, verses 15 to 18.
Colossians 1, verses 15 to 18. Who is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of every creature? For by Him were all things created that are in heaven and that are in earth, visible and invisible. Whether they be thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created by Him and for Him. And He is before all things, and by Him all things consist. And He is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things He might have the preeminence.
Yeah, in all things He might have the preeminence. He is, in fact, the head of all things, visible and invisible. He has that preeminence. And there's a sense in which they bear some resemblance to Him. Christ as the image of God, the Son, that is the eternal Son, as the image of the Father, who then in turn is incarnate in the person of our Lord Jesus Christ, made manifest to us. In that image, by that image, all intelligences are in fact reflected. He bears a relation to them. The angels, because of certain excellences, they actually approximate certain features of the Son of God in a way that far excels the creature. The man. Because they're both creatures. The angels and men are both creatures, but the angels excel men in representing these particular qualities or excellences of the eternal Son of God. They show forth certain aspects in a way that is unparalleled. Now, in addition to all of these things that we are told about the angels, we know that they're of a very great number. So as they are seemingly without number, in fact, if we look at Hebrews 12:22.
Hebrews 12:22. But ye are come unto Mount Zion, and unto the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to an innumerable company of angels.
An innumerable company of angels. There's been discussion of how many angels there are. And it has been suggested that there are at least as many angels as there will be men. I think, certainly with respect to the holy angels, there is reason to think, by way of analogy, that is possible. In fact, the number of the redeemed are categorized in Revelation as an innumerable multitude as well. What that number is, again, we don't know, but if, in fact, there are innumerable angels in heaven, and the number of the elect are also innumerable, there seems to be some kind of an analogy there. There's another little piece of information that figures into our eschatological views, how many will be saved, and that is this. We're told that a third of the angels fell with Satan. And if the ones that remain are an innumerable multitude, and it's somehow analogous to the number of the elect that are an innumerable multitude which are saved, then that may well indicate that not only are a large number going to be saved, but upwards of two-thirds of all mankind would appear in the number of those who will be saved totally and finally. So I don't want to be dogmatic on those points. I just want to point out the analogies. And in terms of the analogy of faith, there is language regarding the angels that would lend itself to our belief and hope that the vast majority of mankind will be saved when all is said and done. Now, these angels, whatever we do with that information, we do know there's an innumerable multitude of them, which indicates that it's such a large number that it is beyond the capacity of men, at least, to number. It's a large, large quantity of these beings. Now, that brings us to the last thing I want to point out with respect to this particular question about angels, that their existence is a matter of necessary observance against the Sadducees, whether ancient or modern. Sadducees are anyone who would deny that there are angels or spirits, either good or evil. Now look at Acts 23:8.
For the Sadducees say there is no resurrection, neither angel nor spirit, but the Pharisees confess both.
It's not a good thing when people deny the existence of angels. They're denying the existence of something not only real, but they're really, a lot of times, the denial of angels is reflective of a denial of anything beyond what we can see. And belief in angels is, in fact, confessing belief that there is not only more to the creation than we can see, but that, in fact, that creation is, the beyond what we can see, is, in fact, the higher creation. And that there is something beyond our ability to see with our eyes. There's a comprehension then higher than this lower comprehension that we have in this fallen world. Now that brings us to the nature of the angels. Question 2. What is the nature of the angels? Well, these angels, as to their nature, are called spirits in Psalm 104:4.
Psalm 104:4, who maketh his angels spirits, his ministers a flaming fire.
And by that, the apostle makes it clear that we are not just speaking about winds. You know, it's not just a matter of him making winds as messengers, as some translations would have it, but we're speaking of intelligent, incorporeal beings, which is confirmed in Hebrews 1:7.
Hebrews 1:7, and of the angels he saith, who maketh his angels spirits, and his ministers a flame of fire.
So he's talking about angels. He's specifically speaking of angels here. And they're spirits. They're pure spirit being. Angels, being pure spirit, are not possessed of corporeal existence. That is, they don't have flesh and bones. That's what that means. Look at Luke 24:39.
Luke 24:39. Behold, my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Handle me and see, for a spirit hath not flesh and bones, as ye see me have.
So when we talk about angels, we're talking about pure spirit being. We're talking about a species of being, of created being, intelligent created being, which does not possess corporeal existence. And again, this goes back to the question of, you know, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? Do they have individual existence? Yes, very clearly they do. Are they, in fact, circumscribed in some way? I mean, they're not omnipresent, right? No, they're not omnipresent. So they are non-corporeal intelligent beings which are not everywhere. They're not omnipresent. That means they have some center of being that is localized, which we'll come back to in a moment. But that raises this question again, and we can't get too far from this as we consider angels, as different as they are. And we'll see other things that lend itself to this idea that there is, just because they are non-corporeal, it does not mean that they don't have some sort of form. That is, something which is circumscribing them. They're not everywhere. They're not omnipresent. And we'll see more evidence of that as we go. So angels may not have corporeal bodies, but they are spirit beings which are, in some sense, circumscribed or and localized beings. And that is why people asked, well, do they have then some kind of incorporeal or non-corporeal body? Some sort of subtle refinement of body. And if we understand by body something giving form, then I think we're constrained to say yes, in some sense, there must be something to that. And again, we'll see that there is other evidence that points us in a direction that should make us consider that there is something. And yet, they're not, we can also say that they're not compounded beings like men. They're not composed of a soul and body. They're not, in fact, compound or composite beings. So that whatever we are going to say about that circumscription or localization, it has to pertain to the created spirit itself. And that bears some relation, as we'll see in a moment, to at least something analogous in man. When we talk about the spirit of man or the soul of man, And although spirit and soul are not exactly the same thing, they are very often in the Bible used interchangeably. But man very clearly has a spiritual component, which is incorporeal, and a bodily component, which is corporeal. Well, this is not the week where we're going to take up the creation of man. We do need to keep that contrast in mind. So, we can derive some sense of the nature of angels from the nature of our souls, which in some respect agree with their nature. Look at Zechariah 12:1 and Hebrews 12:23.
Zechariah 12:1, the word of the Lord for Israel, saith the Lord, which stretched forth the heavens and laid at the foundation of the earth, and formeth the spirit of man within him.
Hebrews 12, verse 23, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn, which are written in heaven, and to God the judge of all, and to the spirits of just men made perfect.
And the spirits of just men made perfect. God forms the spirits of men within him. That there we can see that there's a form to the spirit. There's a, in the creation of that spirit, there's a forming. It's not everywhere. It's not like God, who is everywhere. Created being isn't that way at all. But more importantly, being spirits, we know this. They have the power of thinking, power of understanding, or willing, whether choosing or refusing. We see examples and hints of that in passages like 1 Peter 1:12 and Revelation 19:10.
1 Peter 1, verse 12, unto whom it was revealed that not unto themselves, but unto us, they did minister the things which are now reported unto you by them that have preached the gospel unto you with the Holy Ghost sent down from heaven, which things the angels desire to look into.
Revelation 19:10, and I fell at his feet to worship him, and he said unto me, see thou do it not, I am thy fellow servant and of thy brethren that have the testimony of Jesus. Worship God, for the testimony of Jesus is a spirit of prophecy.
So angels interact with men. Angels are contemplating what's going on in the work of redemption. They're thinking about it. They're trying to understand it. Now, Peter makes it clear, the redemption of man is something which lies far outside of their experience. Because in the world of angels, we don't have a race of angels like men. You know, all the angels are descended from one angel. There's no marriage or giving in marriage among the angels. They don't procreate. They are, in fact, a class of beings, but they're a class of beings which exist as a class of individuals possessed of certain qualities that they share, and yet they're separate or individual beings, each one bearing a relation more directly to God than to one another in that sense, being creatures. Whereas men are beings which bear relation not only to God, their creator, but also to one another in a much more intimate sense. It's not just a sharing of qualities, but there's an actual partaking of being that men have with one another. We're partaking of the same nature, not just like nature. So angels are a group or a class of beings, but they're not a race of beings. They don't share that same nature. But they do have this capacity of thinking, understanding, willing. They are intelligent. They are, in fact, as intelligent beings, we see they're reflective. They're able to reflect upon themselves and upon their relation with the rest of the creation, as well as God. So they're aware not only of their relation to God, but of the relation of man to God. Likewise, we know that they are the subjects of moral government, being under a law capable of moral good or evil, happiness or misery. And that's alluded to in Ephesians 6:12.
Ephesians 6:12. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places.
We're wrestling not against flesh and blood. What are we wrestling against? We're wrestling against spirits, spiritual powers. Why are we? Because some of these powers have not, as we will see, they've not kept their first estate. Some of them have fallen. A third of them, we're told, fell. A third of them, in fact, rebelled, and they're now the angels of the devil. He followed Satan in his apostasy. But the fact that they could fall, the fact that they can obey or disobey God, the fact that they can do his will or not do his will, that all indicates that they're in some sense under moral government. It indicates that they're capable not only of doing moral good or evil, but also they're capable of happiness or misery. And that's why we're told hell was created for the devil and his angels. It's, in fact, brought into existence because they are capable of experiencing misery. And they, in some cases, deserve that. So beyond that, we know that, moreover, angels have power to move, influence, act upon material beings, even as the soul moves and influences a body to which it is united. Genesis 3:1 and Acts 19:15 and 16.
Genesis 3, verse 1. Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field, which the Lord God had made. And he said unto the woman, Yea, hath God said, ye shall not eat of every tree of the garden?
Acts 19, verses 15 and 16. And the evil spirit answered and said, Jesus I know, and Paul I know, but who are ye? And the man in whom the evil spirit was leaped on them and overcame them and prevailed against them, so that they fled out of that house naked and wounded.
Yeah, they have power to move and influence and act upon material beings. Now the examples here are in fact examples of evil angels or demons. But if they can do it, certainly the other angels can as well. And we see that influence. We talk about Ezekiel and his wheel within the wheel and all the angels moving around these wheels, moving the wheels of providence. That idea tells us that the angels are, in fact, moving the wheels of providence. They're the ones that are active in the falling out of the providence of God, so that being created spirit beings, they're still created in such a way that they can influence and act upon and move material being. They're very much intimate with the intelligent creation that is man. And they have been from the beginning. We see Satan there in you know, moving that serpent to speak to Eve in the garden, to tempt the woman. We see that from the very beginning, they have this power to move and influence and work upon material being and bring about their purposes in the creation. And so they have an ability for good or for evil. You know, when they're in obedience to God, when they in fact are holy angels at work, they're doing God's bidding, his will, as we'll see. But when they're not, when they transgress, when they move outside of that, well, they are sinning against God, and they're sinning against all of the creation. You know, they're trying to lead that rebellion farther and deeper. You know, they're not content to rebel on an individual basis. They want to lead all of mankind into this rebellion as well. So, not only can they think and understand and will, not only are they intelligences, but they're active intelligences. And their activity, their level of activity, their ability to act is not limited to the spiritual realm. It has implications. In fact, we'll see in a moment that this extends in a very broad way to the influence of the sons of men. Now, this is understood then by comparing the nature and power of angels and spirits, by comparing them with the nature of the soul. Look at Hebrews 12:9.
Hebrews 12:9. Furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection unto the Father of spirits and live?
Yeah, the Father of spirits. God is the Father of all spirits, and so this nature and power of angels, there is a comparability. You know, spirits are able to move, to activate, to act upon that which is material. That's the whole point. We see it very clearly in men. God breathes in man the breath of life, and he's able to do that. Now, the chief difference is the souls of men are made to be united to corporeal bodies and to act by and upon them. Look at Genesis 2:7 and Ezekiel 18:4.
Genesis 2:7, and the Lord God formed man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils and the breath of life, and man became a living soul.
Ezekiel 18:4. Behold, all souls are mine, as the soul of the Father, so also the soul of the Son is mine. The soul that sinneth, it shall die.
The soul that sinneth, it shall die. Souls, how do souls act? The souls of men act. They're made united with corporeal bodies. And as bodies that are united to souls, they act. They're agents. They are agents of the soul. The angels, on the other hand, are designed to act, exist, and act without corporeal bodies. Hebrews 1:14. They're ministering spirits. They're existing and acting without corporeal bodies. Again, it does not mean that they're omnipresent. Right? They're circumscribed. They're locally present spirits. In fact, they too, because they're not everywhere, they can be hindered in their movement from one place to another. We see this in Daniel 10:10-14.
Daniel 10:10-14. And behold, an hand touched me, which set me upon my knees and upon the palms of my hands. And he said unto me, O Daniel, a man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak unto thee, and stand upright. For unto thee am I now sent. And when he had spoken this word unto me, I stood trembling. Then said he unto me, Fear not, Daniel, from the first day that thou didst set thine heart to understand, and to chasten thyself before thy God, thy words were heard, and I am come for thy words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia without withstood me one and twenty days, but lo, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, and I remained there with the kings of Persia. Now I am come to make thee understand what shall befall thy people in the latter days, for yet the vision is for many days.
Okay, so they're circumscribed, locally present spirits. They're not everywhere at once. They're not, in fact, unable to be hindered even. We can see that you know, spirit beings can hinder other spirit beings. That there is a battle going on that we don't see, an unseen battle. Now, that same story is told, if you remember, in Elisha's case, when his servant was concerned about their situation, and God opens his eyes to see the chariots that are surrounding them, the chariots of the angels. They're everywhere, and yet we don't see them. We also know that they're able to move rapidly, that they're not moving through time and space in the same way that we are. They're moving through time and space from eternity, if you will, looking in and touching in. They move from eternity into time and space and back again. And so they're not... hindered in that way. They're not hindered by material hindrances, but they're still able to be hindered. And they're still not able to be in every place at once. They're limited. You know, and that includes, by the way, Satan. You know, a lot of people think that Satan's everywhere and he can do this and he can do... He can't. He too is limited to being in one place at one time, and he's got plenty of things to do without worrying about most people. Believe me, there are plenty of demons to take care of the rest of mankind and see that they do his bidding. All right, although they exist without union to corporeal bodies, yet they're not without some form discernible at times to men. And we know that, again, because of some of the accounts in Scripture. For example, Genesis 18:2 and Acts 1:10.
Genesis 18, verse 2. And he lifted up his eyes and looked, and lo, three men stood by him. When he saw them, he ran to meet them from the tent door and bowed himself toward the ground.
Acts 1:10. While they looked steadfastly toward heaven as he went up, behold, two men stood by them in white apparel.
Sometimes this form that they take is a subtle form, and it shields their true identity. We don't really perceive every angel as an angel. And that's clear if we look at Hebrews 13:2.
Hebrews 13, verse 2. Be not forgetful to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares.
How could you entertain angels unawares if it were not possible for them to appear to men in a form that was intelligible and yet subtle enough that it wouldn't immediately suggest to you that you're dealing with an angel that you don't know, right? On the other hand, sometimes this form does not shield their true identity, as we see in Matthew 28:2-4.
Matthew 28:2-4. Behold, there was a great earthquake, for the angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone from the door and sat upon it. His countenance was like lightning, and his raiment white as snow. And for the fear of him, the keepers did shake and became as dead men.
So, if you see an angel, the point of this is sometimes you wouldn't even know it. Other times you couldn't miss the point. But it also tells us that although they are invisible, that they're invisible creation, that they're spirit, that they're pure spirit, they're pure spirit that can project themselves into this material world in a way that makes them visible to men. You know, whether or not it comes with all of the bells and whistles of making you fall down on your face and tremble before them, or you didn't even know that you were having dinner with them. It can be that extreme, we're told. They're not necessarily going to be known by us. And yet, in each case along this spectrum, we can see that they are discernible by us. We can, in fact, perceive them. They can make themselves known to us. And furthermore, we see that their appearances are in a form resembling men. When they appear to men, they appear to men as men. They look like men to us. We're not sitting there saying, what is that? They don't look like some sort of alien creatures that are so bizarre that we're fearing them because they look like monsters. When men are stricken with awe at the sight of an angel, it's not because they've been confronted with something monstrous, but because they've been confronted with something so glorious that it's literally mind-boggling and makes them recognize the glorious excellence of the creation that is the angel. So the fact that they can project themselves, or do project themselves, in some sense resembling men, and even Satan, we're told, will project himself as an angel of light, that is, as something desirable. Even in that case, you know, that tells us that there's some analogous relation between angels and men. Look again at Luke 24, 4 and 5.
Luke 24, verses 4 and 5. And it came to pass, as they were much perplexed thereabout, behold, two men stood by them in shining garments. And as they were afraid and bowed down their faces to the earth, they said unto them, why seek ye the living among the dead?
If we just think about that for a moment, they appear in shining garments. Well, remember, men are wearing clothing because of sin. By the fall, we lost union and communion with God, and we've lost that Shekinah, that glory of God that covered men. Men, in all likelihood before the fall, would shine with the presence of God like Moses did when he was in the presence of God. He came out and his face shone, we're told. These angels are shining. They're in garments that are glistening. You know, they're clothed in what may well be best described as light. Robes of light. They're just covered in this. This is their covering. This is what makes them stand out when they reveal themselves in their glory to men, when men are inclined to see them not merely as strangers, but clearly as angels. They perceive in them this degree of glory. All of that, the fact that they're projecting themselves to us in the material world, that they appear to us as men, That, I think, indicates this kind of continuity in the creation that should make us consider, not only has God created them as spirit beings with respect to himself and his service, but there's a continuity in the creation between angels and men. So that angels are not simply, even if they're not created necessarily with a direct like racial connection to one another, like men, the fact is that they do bear a resemblance. They're created in the same image that man has been created in, and that is the eternal Son of God. And all of that carries with it implications. The implications have, I think, direct bearing here. The saints from their birth, in particular, are under the care of these angels. We see this if we look at Psalm 34:7 and Psalm 91:11.
Psalm 34, verse 7, "The angel of the Lord encampeth round about them that fear him, and delivereth them."
Psalm 91, verse 11, "For he shall give his angels charge over thee, to keep thee in all thy ways."
Yeah, he gives his angels charge over his people, in particular to keep them. In fact, we know that just as he sends ill angels or evil angels to plague the wicked, we see in John's gospel an angel troubling the water so that men would be healed. Angels are intimately involved with men and their care or their punishment, depending on whether they're saints or the wicked. They're there. And apparently they accompany them as what some people have called guardian angels. There is some thought of this in the Bible. I want to look at two passages, Matthew 18:10 and Acts 12:15.
Matthew 18, verse 10. "Take heed that ye despise not one of these little ones, for I say unto you that in heaven their angels do always behold the face of my Father which is in heaven."
Acts 12:15. "And they said unto her, Thou art mad, for she constantly affirmed that it was even so. Then said they, It is his angel."
Yeah, the first case, Jesus is warning people not to offend children because their angels are always before the face of God. And from that, people have said, well, then every child has a guardian angel and so on. Whether or not there's one or many angels, the fact is that the saints of God, his people, are clearly assigned angelic protection. Angels, we're told, for example, go before their way. When Abraham's servant goes to find a wife for Isaac, and he praises the angel of God to go before him and prepare a way. They're there. They're at work behind the scenes. We don't always see what they're doing. When Peter shows up at the door, and this is another interesting and I think curious thing, that they wrote thinks that it's Peter, but they're sure it's just his angel. Now, that would suggest that your angel may in fact look something like you, if there are guardian angels, that they bear some resemblance to you, that there is in fact some kind of analogous relation, even in the department of resemblancing. But whether it's one or many, I don't know that we're warranted to speak of a guardian angel per se, but certainly we are warranted to say that the angels are looking over us, that God has appointed them to look over us if we're saints. If we're sinners, God has appointed them to plague us. And in fact, they're going to continually be dragging us down, the danger of dabbling in occultic activity. Is that these angels can appear as angels of light. You know, you don't see the evil. You don't even see what you're getting into. They are there. They're real. They're at work. They can influence you. You know, you are already, because of original sin, a bundle of dry debris ready to catch fire. And when you engage in anything that is even remotely questionable, when you put yourself in positions where you're surrounding yourself with people who are clearly not believers. Look, if they're not believers, I can tell you without any shadow of doubt. Just as the saints are surrounded by angels that are there to guard them, the wicked are surrounded by demons. And they're everywhere. And they're dangerous. They're there to trip you up. You know, you're having trouble resisting sin. Look at your company. Look at who you're hanging with. You know, you're hanging with demons. And you wonder why you're having trouble? You shouldn't be wondering why. There is a real world that we don't see. That's, again, the whole point. Elisha tells his servant to pray that God would open his eyes, and he looks around, he sees all these chariots of fire around him, guarding him. The mountains are full of them. Where did they come from? They're there all the time. There's a spiritual battle going on. We don't see it. We're wrestling not against flesh and blood, remember, but against principalities and powers in high places. When Gabriel wants to go to talk to Daniel, he set out for the first day, but he's hindered until he's helped. So these angels are real. And there are good ones and there are bad ones. There are evil angels. We'll come back to how that came to be in a moment. But there are evil angels. They're not all good. This is, again, a problem when people want to venerate angels and things like that. Be very careful. They are there. They're real. They're moving the wheels of providence. Again, as Ezekiel holds forth to us, that wheel in the wheel. They're at work. Now, these angels, being spirits and incorporeal, are immortal. That is to say, they're not subject to corruption. Look at Luke 20, 36.
Luke 20, verse 36. Neither can they die anymore, for they are equal unto the angels and are the children of God, being the children of the resurrection.
A spirit being doesn't die. It's not subject to death. It's immortal. Nothing is subject to death or dissolution but that which is compounded of parts. Because death is the dissolution of composition of those parts before united. Look at Ecclesiastes 12, 7.
Ecclesiastes 12, verse 7. Then the dust returned to the earth as it was, and the spirit shall return unto God who gave it.
It's the composition of soul and body, the spirit and the body in the man. That's what can be dissolved by death. The spirit doesn't die. When God creates a spirit, it's created immortal. It's not that there's something there that couldn't be taken away, right? The spirit might be annihilated. It could be annihilated, but it's not going to die. Spirit doesn't die. It would take an act of God in reverse to creation for that to disappear. Since the power that brought it out of nothing could, in fact, return it to nothing. That's possible. 1 Corinthians 1, 28 and Matthew 19, 26.
1 Corinthians 1, 28. And base things of the world and things which are despised hath God chosen, yea, and things which are not, to bring to naught things at all.
Matthew 19, verse 26, But Jesus beheld them and said unto them, With men this is impossible, but with God all things are possible.
So we say that the spirit is immortal. What we mean is this: no spirit being can cease to be of its own accord. God could annihilate it. He could, you know, smash it back into non-being, back to the nothingness, blow it back into the nothingness from whence it came. But he's ordained, in fact, that spirit being is such that it's going to exist forever. Once he's created it, unless he were to annihilate it, which he's given us no indication it's his will to do, then it's going to exist forever. It can't destroy itself. Right? The spirit can't destroy itself. Look at Matthew 22:30.
Matthew 22:30. For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as the angels of God in heaven.
As the angels of God in heaven. They're there forever. They're going to exist forever. They don't need to marry or give in marriage. There is a number which is sure. There won't be any marriage or giving in marriage in heaven. Why? Because the number is not going to be increased or diminished. It's going to be fixed. Just like the angels, it's going to be fixed. The difference is man got there through a process of procreation. Man got there as a race. The angels are there having been created as individual spirit beings. They're ordained that they would exist forever once God creates spirit. Thus, they're immortal not only from the constitution of their nature, but more importantly, by the will of God. Revelation 21:4.
Revelation 21:4. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away.
There won't be any more death. What is that? The former things are passed away. God has not ordained to uncreate what he has created. So he's created spirit beings that will remain. He's not going to undo that. Death is the dissolution of the composite parts, but even that is going to be reversed. Even the wicked will be resurrected unto eternal damnation, but they'll be resurrected because that dissolution is not, in fact, it's the result of sin. It's not part of God's creation. It's not part of his will for the creature. He created man, he created him a composite being or compounded being. And man may for a time suffer that loss of or deprivation of body, being a disembodied soul for a time in the intermediate state, but it won't be for eternity. For eternity, all men will be reunited. Death will be overcome in that regard. Eternal death, when we talk about eternal death, it is analogous to that separation of soul and body, but the separation is from God himself for eternity. So there's an immortality of soul which pertains to the nature of spirit, but is also upheld by the will of God. Now, that God created these angels with certain excellencies and qualities appears especially in these three things. There are three things that our catechism holds out to us regarding the excellence of being an angel, or the quality of wherein angels excel. First, they were all created holy without blemish of any kind. Matthew 25:31.
Matthew 25:31. When the Son of Man shall come in his glory, and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory.
Well, they're called holy angels. They're with him forever. If he had created any of the angels, in fact, in a state of enmity, opposition to, or rebellion against himself, he could never have pronounced all things very good at the end of the creation, which is what he does in Genesis 1:31.
Genesis 1:31. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And the evening and the morning were the sixth day.
So the fact is, and the reason I think the Bible does stress this to the degree it does, or makes this point known to the degree it does, is so that we do understand, just as in the case of man, So in the case of the angels that fall, the third of the angels that do not remain upright and holy, that the cause of that is not traceable to God. When we talk about the immediate cause, God, was it part of God's decree? Yes. Was it, in fact, subject to God's decree in all points? Yes. But the sinfulness, the evil, the wickedness that attends the fall of the angels, all of that arises wholly and solely from those angels which fell. God didn't create them in a state of enmity, nor were they inclined to that. But as we'll see, just like men, they were created, and it is the very nature of the creature to be mutable, so that without some sort of confirmation, this was and would have remained a possibility that they could fall. So although they're created holy, the angels that remain in this state, even we have to say that this holiness does not actually compare with that of the Lord. We call them holy, but that's with respect to what we understand. But if we were to compare them with God, they're not really. Look at Revelation 15:4.
Revelation 15, verse 4. Who shall not fear thee, O Lord, and glorify thy name? For thou only art holy. For all nations shall come and worship before thee, for thy judgments are made manifest.
Yeah, thou only art holy. Well, wait a minute, how can there be holy angels? Yeah. Again, this is comparatively. In terms of the creation, there's nothing more holy than these holy angels. But the creation, when the creation itself, even the holiest of creation, is held up to be compared with the Lord, only God is holy. Right, and the reason is that in his eyes, the very heavens are not clean. Job 15:15.
Job 15:15. Behold, he putteth no trust in his saints. Yea, the heavens are not clean in his sight.
Yeah, the heavens are not clean in his sight. There's no comparison. No, if we're going to compare with the Lord, there's no comparison. Creation. The point of this is creation does not compare. But that's not to say that they're not really and truly holy. They are. In the context of the creation, there's nothing holier, there's nothing grander than these angels, at least until the incarnation of the Son of God. And in that, by the way, in that is the key to the elevation of men. God created man a little lower than the angels, but he's crowned him with glory and honor and dignity. He's lifted him up above them, but he did so by becoming man. He didn't do that. It's not natural for the man to be excelling the angel, but it is by reason of redemption. It is so that man, at least redeemed men, will excel the angels in glory. All right, second, beyond being created holy, we know that they were created excelling in knowledge or in wisdom, which is the greatest beauty or advancement of knowledge. 2 Samuel 14:20.
2 Samuel 14:20, to fetch about this form of speech hath thy servant Joab done this thing. And my Lord is wise according to the wisdom of an angel of God to know all things that are in the earth.
Yeah, wise according to an angel of God to know all things in the earth. That's telling us they understood the angels knew everything that could be known. Right? Anything knowable, an angel can know. Which is why the moment your eyes wander or you speak something aloud, the angels know, including the bad ones. They can't know the thoughts of the heart. That is, they don't know your innermost thoughts until your thoughts betray themselves in your eyes, your actions, your words. Once you do that, once you speak it, they know. It's knowable. It's become knowable. And the angels that need to know, both good and evil, they know. Even though they have this excellence in knowledge, they excel, they're not privy to that knowledge which alone pertains to the deity. Matthew 24:36.
Matthew 24:36. But of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only.
Yeah, they don't know when the second coming will be exactly. They know things which are, in fact, matters of knowledge that are either revealed. I mean, the devil knows the Bible better than anyone, any man, certainly, except for Jesus. He knows that better. He's aware of what it means. The demons, if you remember when Christ, when he approaches the demoniac, the demons cry out and say, it's not time yet. They know it's not time yet. They know that they're not to the end of time when they're going to suffer the torments of hell forever. They know they're not there yet. That's something which is a matter of knowledge. They can have that knowledge. They know all of that, right? In comparison of which the knowledge of the very angels, when we talk about the knowledge of the deity, we talk about the knowledge of God, the knowledge of the angels is but folly in comparison to that.
Job 4:18. Behold, he put no trust in his servants, and his angels he charged with folly.
Yeah, his angels he charged with folly. That is, it's not that they were foolish. It's not that they were wayward in any sense. It's just simply that compared to what God knows, what God understands, the greatest excellence of knowing and understanding in a creature is going to be in an angel. And yet, they don't. What they know is foolishness. It's folly compared to that. Nevertheless, this knowledge does consist in a capacity to reason upon matters of moral relevance and perceive all things subject to created knowing. 2 Samuel 14:17.
2 Samuel 14:17. Then thine handmaid said, the word of my lord the king shall now be comfortable, for as an angel of God, so is my lord the king to discern good and bad. Therefore the Lord thy God will be with thee.
So angels can know anything that is subject to created, anything a creature can know. Angels can know. And given the opportunity, they will know. They don't know everything. They're not everywhere. But consider what they're up to. Their movement through creation, they're certainly in a position, because of this excellence of knowledge or wisdom, to pick up whatever they don't know, given a particular circumstance arising. Right? They don't know the future unless they've discerned it from prophecy. But they do know when certain situations arise, they have all of the knowledge needed to deal with a certain situation. They're either going to do it, by the way, as good angels who are carrying out the command of God in a situation, or as evil angels, in which case they may be trying to come up with some new way to tempt you. But they're going to be knowledgeable, far, far more knowledgeable. They're going to know you better than yourself. You know, they're going to know, they know everything about you. They've got the dossier on your life, the evil angels that are going to try to draw you aside. They know everything you've ever done, everything you've ever said, every approach you've ever made to the dark side. It's all there. You know what's going to tempt you, what's going to catch your attention, and they're subtle. All right, the third thing is we know that they were created mighty in power, whereby they're fitted to accomplish whatever tasks might fall to them. 2 Thessalonians 1, 7.
2 Thessalonians 1, verse 7. And to you who are troubled, rest with us when the Lord Jesus shall be revealed from heaven with his mighty angels.
They're called mighty angels because their power is far beyond what we could imagine. Remember, our power is limited to that which is or pertains to this creation that we can see. But their power extends into the unseen. And their power is, in fact, far in excess of any power given any man or army of men upon the earth. We can see how powerful an angel is if we look at 2 Kings 19, 32-35.
2 Kings 19, verses 32-35. Therefore thus saith the Lord concerning the king of Assyria, he shall not come into this city, nor shoot an arrow there, nor come before it with shield, nor cast a bank against it. By the way that he came, by the same shall he return, and shall not come into this city, saith the Lord. For I will defend this city to save it for mine own sake, and for my servant David's sake. And it came to pass that night that the angel of the Lord went out and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when they arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses.
Yeah, so one angel can just sort of reach out his hand and slap, and people just start dying. You know, they've got tremendous power. And we need to remember that the power of the demons, evil angels, is circumscribed. If we're believers, if we're saints of God, then they're not getting quite the free access to us that they are to the wicked. That doesn't mean that they're not petitioning like Satan did in the case of Job. They're continually begging for an opportunity to trip us up. Be assured of that. That's part of your occupation if you're a demon. And what makes them scary is that they really are this powerful. They're this powerful when they're good angels. They're that powerful when they're evil angels. We need to keep that in mind. We're dealing with forces beyond our comprehension. It's a dangerous thing to deny that there's anything beyond what we can see. All right, so the third question then, what is the work in which the angels are engaged? Well, the work, particularly talking about the holy angels here, the work or employment of these angels consists in two branches. First of all, they are created to execute the commands of God in the creation. Psalm 103, 20 and 21.
Psalm 103, verses 20 and 21. Bless the Lord, ye his angels, that excel in strength, that do his commandments, hearkening unto the voice of his word. Bless ye the Lord, all ye his hosts, ye ministers of his, that do his pleasure.
Okay, so they're created to execute the commands of God in creation. God, in fact, is not doing things generally in a direct way as we would think of it. His direct way of interjecting his power into the creation is to have his angels accomplish whatever it is. They're ministering spirits. They're sent to accomplish what he commands them to do. And they do it. They wait constantly upon the Lord in glory in order to carry out his will in all things. See this in Isaiah 6, verses 2, 6, and 7.
Isaiah 6, verse 2. Above it stood the seraphims, each one had six wings. With twain he covered his face, and with twain he covered his feet, and with twain he did fly. Verses 6 and 7. Then flew one of the seraphims unto me, having a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with the tongs from off the altar. And he laid it upon my mouth, and said, Lo, this hath touched thy lips, and thine iniquity is taken away, and thy sin purged.
There's nothing which is subject to his command they will not do, being in all respects fitted to this service. If he commands them to do it, they'll do it. That's what they're created to do. Matthew 26:53.
Thinkest thou that I cannot now pray to my Father, and he shall presently give me more than 12 legions of angels?
Okay, so they're there to serve God. Right, second, they were created to praise his name. Look at Psalm 148:2.
Psalm 148:2, praise ye him, all his angels, praise ye him, all his hosts.
And this extends to the work of redemption as well as the work of creation. Luke 2:13-14.
Luke 2:13-14, and suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of heavenly hosts praising God and saying, Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men.
Right. And this they're doing by divine warrant, which they yield at the incarnation. Just as they were there at the laying of the creation of the world, so they're there doing the same or performing the same duty at the incarnation, at the beginning of the new creation. That's what they were called to do. Look at Hebrews 1:6.
Hebrews 1:6. And again, when he bringeth in the first begotten into the world, he saith, Let all the angels of God worship him.
Okay. So, we see then that this is the engagement of angels. They were created to carry out God's commands as well as to praise his name. And the holy angels are doing that. They're doing it in a most excellent way. Before we address that, the last question, I want to interject one point here that I didn't address along the way, and that is this question of archangels and so on. We have the name of two angels, Gabriel and Michael, in the Bible. The Apocrypha gives us a third angel named Raphael. The fact is that Michael is called an archangel. It's highly likely that Michael is really just simply a pre-incarnate Christ. And by archangel, what we should understand is that he, arche means ruler of the angels. Archangel means ruler of the angels. And that's just a title of Christ as the ruler of the angels. So there is evidence of that in Scripture. If you look at Michael, he is in fact doing the very things that we would expect Christ to be doing. He's heading up the angelic host against the devil and his angels in the book of Revelation. And he is, in fact, engaged on behalf of Gabriel when he's trying to get to Daniel. So that there is reason to believe that he is, in fact, pre-incarnate Christ. Which leaves us with Gabriel, and there have been sundry theories floated with regard to Gabriel. But he seems to be the one talking to Daniel, and he's also the one who appears at the time of the virgin birth. He seems to be the only other angel that's named, and may well be the only angel whose name we really have. Michael's name means who is like God, who is like God. And that name in and of itself seems to be pointing to Christ as well. So that's something else that you can keep in mind. The last question we want to talk about just ever so briefly is the last point brought up in this question, were they created immutable? And the answer is that notwithstanding all the natural advantages with which they were created, they were, in fact, created subject to change. 2 Peter 2:4.
For if God spared not the angels that sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved unto judgment.
If some of the angels sinned, and we're told again in Revelation that it's a third of the angels fell. We see that Satan fell from heaven. We know that he was a liar from the beginning. We're told that he sinned against God. And that a third of the angels follow him in this apostasy. They have natural advantages, but as creatures, they're still mutable. And although they're not subject to corruption, that is to death, because they're not compounded or composite beings, nonetheless, they are intelligent creatures, and they are capable of apostasy. And that's what's happened in this case with the devil and his angels. And thus, some who were created holy not only were subject to change, but we're told actually fell, becoming rebels and enemies of God. Jude verse 6.
And the angels which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, he hath reserved in everlasting chains under darkness unto the judgment of the great day.
We're told by Jude that they kept not their first estate. They were, in fact, angels created in holiness. This is, if you want to know the origin of demons and of the devil and all of that, they're fallen angels. And I've alluded to it throughout the evening, but that's really what they are. There were no other beings, intelligent spirit beings, other than angels that were created, and some of them, because they were mutable, they were able to fall, and some of them actually did fall. And again, the number that we were given is approximately a third of them. Nonetheless, the number that remained faithful in comparison to that is an innumerable multitude. So we shouldn't be afraid. There are many, many more holy angels for every fallen angel. You know, they're outnumbered at least 2 to 1 from what we can tell. And if we remember that in the case not only of holiness and excellence of knowledge, but in terms of might, you know, the sovereignty of God is such that it excels all of the angels totally. You know, there's nothing that compares, you know, next to the sovereignty of God. There's just nothing like that. There's nothing even remotely comparable. So that we shouldn't be afraid. You know, people who are constantly fearful of devils and Satan and all of that, the only time you should be afraid, if you're not faithful to God, if you're sinning, you should be afraid, because you're opening yourself up to an eternity with the devil and his angels. I mean, hell was created for them, and that's where the wicked will spend eternity with the devil and his angels. But if you're a saint of God and you're striving to be faithful to God, if you're elect of God, you're not going to be deceived, and you're not going to be totally and finally lost to them. Their power is limited. As Luther said, even the devil is God's devil and he's on God's chain. They can't go beyond that. So it's important then to remember that when we talk about creation, the creation of intelligent agents, and note, it's only the larger catechism that brings up the issue of angels. Angels do help us understand certain features of pure spirit being. And they also help us understand that being spirits, if they're created, is not in and of itself going to prevent one from falling into sin. They're still mutable until and unless they're confirmed in glory. Now, God, we believe, has now confirmed the holy angels in their estate. That's that episode with the falling of the angels is over. Whereas redemption of men carries on, and the angels now as Peter says, they're bending over. They're trying to understand what's going on with redemption. Because remember, when the angels fell, both Peter and Jude tell us God cast them down into hell. They didn't get another opportunity. When man fell, God intervened himself in the flesh and brought redemption to men. And that whole concept of redemption then to angels is very alien because they either remained in their first estate or they didn't. But they didn't have this middle ground of redemption where God interjects himself to redeem those who fell. Nor do they have that opportunity to be raised up above what they were created to be, as does man. And so the eternal Son of God taking upon himself not the nature of angels, but the seed of Abraham, in doing so, he elevates the nature of man above that of the nature of angels. That's what's going on. Next time, we'll take up the question of the creation of man and begin to look at some of the related and analogous topics that we've talked about with angels, but particularly with respect to man.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at puritandownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at puritandownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan Hard Drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan Hard Drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan Hard Drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan Hard Drive is for you. Visit puritandownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan Hard Drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwater's Revival Books.